Welcome everyone to You Make Me Sick, here with your host Michaela Wynn. Today we have special guest Allison Kilblind with us, who is from Boston Medical Center. She's our nurse educator in the medical intensive care unit. Welcome, Allison.
Thank you, Michaela. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you here today. We're going to talk about ICU delirium and kind of what it is, how it impacts patients, the history behind it, and a special project that Allison had worked on in her doctorate program. So Allison, do you want to get us started and just kind of tell us a little bit about delirium? Like, what is delirium for people that are unclear about that?
Sure. So delirium is something that's been around for a very long time. It was defined a very long time ago. I don't know the date exactly, but if you look at the like Greek philosophers, they were talking about delirium even back then. So delirium is something that can happen in or outside of a hospital, but it really is characterized by an acute change in mental status, and a lot of times it can be reversible. In hospital settings, delirium is a really big deal because as you get delirious, you can have worse patient outcomes, which then, you know, can lead to higher costs and higher length of stays. So it really is just acute confusion. And it's something that we as nurses can help to prevent. And that's kind of what it is. It differs from things like dementia, where dementia is something that is a progressive and ongoing confusion. Yeah. Delirium is something that happens really acutely and just can really impact what's going on with the patient in the hospital.
Yeah. So I think like what you're saying is the biggest difference between delirium and dementia was like the delirium being the acute onset of something, the mental status. And then how would you say that delirium differs from psychosis?
Especially in the ICU, we really look at delirium more so than even on like regular medical floors, because there's so much that happens in the ICU and there's so much stimulation in an ICU that it really, it's studied a lot looking at delirium specific to the ICU. Something like psychosis or ICU psychosis, that is also a change in mental status, but that a lot of times can be related to like the drugs that we're giving, or we can help treat it with medications. Whereas delirium is something that is the very acute change in mental status that sometimes we can't treat with medications. And it's really like how we are taking care of the patient in the environment that really impacts it.
And I think the environment plays a huge factor, and we see delirium a lot in the ICU. Why do you think that in the ICU delirium is more prevalent than maybe on a medical surgical floor?
That is a great question. So a lot of the factors that play into delirium are diagnoses. So in the ICU, you know, we see the sickest of the sick patients. So diagnoses like COPD or congestive heart failure, those actually predispose people to getting delirium, something like sepsis, which we see a lot of in the ICU. And then the biggest impact, or one of the biggest impacts that I found when I was doing my literature review that affects delirium, is the environment. So light and noise specifically. I actually wanted to do my project initially on something with decreasing light and noise for ICU patients, but it didn't work out. But light and noise. And if you've ever been in an ICU, there are, you know, lots of beeps, there's ventilators, there's IV pumps, there's nurses, there's the TV, you know, then we're shining flashlights in people's eyes, sometimes every hour. So all of that to take care of the patient, it's, you know, we have to do this stuff to take care of the patient. But on the flip side, all of these things help to keep our patients awake and they're not getting restful sleep. And sleep is a huge component of why delirium develops. And like I said, the environment, the light and the noise really plays a part in how patients are getting sleep.
Yeah, I definitely agree with those factors that contribute to it. I think that you know, one of the things you had said was, you know, shining a light in patients' eyes. And, you know, we do this with our patients who need neurological checks every hour in the intensive care unit. Care is usually provided every hour, you know, medications, dressing changes, checking on patients' mental status. And so all these things are preventing our patients from getting sleep.
Exactly.
We all know what happens when we don't get our sleep.
Exactly.
You know, you had said that there are some diagnoses that patients come in with that can be classified for them developing delirium. Can you give us some specific like instances that patients would come in and we would characterize them more as the patient that would end up with sepsis as opposed to other patients that we may see?
So like in terms of what patient diagnoses we might see that would lead to them developing delirium.
Yeah,
so there's this fun little acronym. It's called Dr. Dre, but that goes through, you know, it talks about different diagnoses, and sepsis is a big one, which we see a lot of in the medical ICU. A lot of patients that develop sepsis need to come to the ICU just because they're so sick. They end up with low blood pressure or high heart rates or fevers. So sepsis is a big one. And then COPD, so breathing problems, and congestive heart failure, kind of breathing problems, those contribute a lot to the development of delirium. But I honestly don't know if it's the diagnosis itself or if it's because these patients end up on ventilators. And when you end up on a ventilator, you know, you're stimulating the patient more because we have to suction them. And so it prevents them from getting the good sleep. And then along with that, the ventilator beeps and makes noise. And if we're turning our patients, that beeping happens, which then again is extra noise that can help, that prevents them from getting that good REM sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like the sedation and the ventilator definitely play a role in it. And, you know, our patients with encephalopathy and uremia, all those factors that
exactly
kind of cloud their mental status.
And I'm actually glad, if you don't mind me interrupting, I'm glad you mentioned encephalopathy, because encephalopathy, for those of you that don't know, is kind of also acute confusion, and it's kind of like brain swelling, and it can lead to confusion in patients. And interestingly, the CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, they currently classify encephalopathy as a major complication or comorbidity. So patients that develop encephalopathy in the hospital, they get coded differently and more reimbursement happens. Delirium is not considered encephalopathy. So patients that are diagnosed with delirium in the hospital don't get reimbursed as at the same rate as people that get encephalopathy, which is interesting because they're both acute changes in mental status, and we know how much delirium impacts length of stay, costs, all of that stuff. So the American Psychological Association, I think, they're really pushing the government to try to make delirium a major complication or comorbidity so that patients or like so that reimbursement happens at a different rate because so many people develop it.
Yeah. Wow, that is very interesting. I hope that that does come into play. I know that we have talked about, you know, changes in healthcare, and even with patients with multiple wounds and pressure injuries and skin breakdown, we have now advanced to a point where we can characterize patients with skin failure. You know, there's just some situations in which there was no way to prevent some of these issues from happening. And I feel like delirium is one of those things, you know, if we need to do our every hour neuro checks, you know, the patient's not going to get sleep and they're most likely going to end up with delirium. And there's just, you know, the benefit outweighs the risk in these situations. And so hopefully, if you said it was the American Psychological Association.
Yeah. And I think like 15 other associations are trying to fight for it, but so far no luck.
So Allison, do you mind telling us a little bit about the characteristics of delirium?
Sure. So there's actually, first of all, there's three different kinds of delirium. So there's hyperactive delirium, there's hypoactive delirium, and there's mixed delirium. Hyperactive delirium, a lot of times nurses like know these patients. These patients are the ones that are hitting and trying to pull out their lines and pull out their tubes, and they're aggressive. And so nurses very much identify these patients early on. And some other characteristics that go along with that is an acute change in mental status. So one of the things we ask the patients is, you know, what day is today? What's your name? Like, when's your birthday? And if they're having confusion, that can be like kind of a point towards, oh, they might be getting delirious. Inattention is a big one. So if you ask them a question, are they able to like follow what you're asking them and answer the appropriate way? You know, if I ask you what is today's day of the week and you say to me like, I like ice cream, that's kind of inattention. And then some other things are asking patients just to follow simple commands. So we actually have this acronym. It's called Save a Heart. So it's SAVEAHAART. So we spell it a little bit differently. And we basically take the patient's hand and say, squeeze my hand when you hear me say the letter A. So if you say S, A, you should feel the patient squeeze your hand. V, E, A, you should feel the patient squeeze your hand. One way patients fail that is by either not squeezing your hand at all or squeezing on inappropriate letters. And so some patients are not going to squeeze your hand at all. They're just like not paying attention. That's a key sign of delirium development. So that's like kind of all hyperactive delirium. Like I said, nurses tend to know these patients because they're very like resource heavy. You know, you're in the room trying to redirect them. The one that nurses miss a lot, and actually the literature supports that we miss a lot of delirium because of these patients, is hypoactive delirium. Hypoactive delirium is the patient that's laying in bed and they're quiet and they're not pulling their lines, they're not pulling their tubes. And so as you can imagine, those patients don't get as much like resources as the ones that are like trying to hit or bite or like, you know, trying to do all of that stuff. The ones that are calm and quiet, they actually develop delirium at an increased rate from the ones that are hyperactive, but nurses just tend to miss them because we're not putting the resources into them when they're not doing these things that are like, they're like their care is being poorly managed. It would be the same kind of thing. You'd ask those patients the same question, you know, what's today's day of the week? And if they say, I like ice cream, that is considered, okay, maybe they're going to be delirious. We ask them to squeeze our hands. And then there's mixed delirium, which is, you know, the patients are kind of aggressive, but they also can be subdued. And so those ones get missed a lot too, because when the patients, like I said, are subdued, I don't want to say we're not taking as much care of them, but they're just, they seem like kind of on the surface to be doing better. So we're not in the room as much potentially.
Do you think the outcomes on these patients differ because of like the attention that we may be giving to those patients that are hyperactive delirium as opposed to hypoactive?
I do think that the outcomes differ. I think that especially when I was doing all my like literature review, it's clear that delirium is missed a lot by nurses. And it seems that the hypoactive delirious patients are that's what we're missing a lot of the times. And so we know that delirium leads to worse outcomes to begin with. Like all patients that develop delirium just have worse outcomes. Their 6-month mortality rate after the hospital increases. They have the longer length of stay, which then can lead to like pressure injuries and, you know, pneumonias, or they can get sicker just by being in the hospital. And so I think the fact that we are missing these hypoactive delirium cases, that's where I think they have poor, like worse outcomes because we just are missing it.
Yeah. You had talked about like kind of the orientation questions, some of the behavior issues kind of being like our early warning signs for these patients with delirium. Is there like an assessment tool that nurses are doing in the hospital to assess for delirium on patients?
There is. So the Society of Critical Care Medicine, it's an organization that's made up of, you know, anesthesiologists and doctors and nurses, respiratory therapists, pharmacy. It's an national organization made up of like these ICU specific stakeholders that make best practice advisories for how we can care for patients. And one thing they had developed was called the ABCDEF bundle of ICU liberation. And it's basically like, how do we treat these patients to get them out of the ICU sooner? And the D stands for delirium. Like, how can we manage delirium? So they actually have two evidence-based and validated tools that they recommend to evaluate for delirium. One of them is called the CAM ICU score. It's the Confusion Assessment Method score. And that goes through four specific questions for the nurse to ask the patient to see if we can evaluate for delirium. It's either positive or negative. The patient's either positive for delirium or negative for delirium based on these questions. And then they also recommend the ICDSC tool, which is the Intensive Care Delirium Screening Tool. And that is 8 questions, similar questions to what the CAM ICU asks, but it also asks about the patient's like sleep behaviors, which is a huge reason patients get delirious. That's kind of like positive or negative, but it's if the score is greater than 4, then the patient's considered delirious. If it's greater than 3, then we worry, okay, maybe they're heading towards delirium, so we can implement interventions sooner. But both of these tools are recommended, and so most ICUs should be using one of these tools to evaluate their patient every shift for delirium.
Do you favor one over the other?
You know, most hospitals that I just like anecdotally use the CAM ICU tool. That's what we use at Boston Medical Center. And when I was looking into delirium, I started looking at this ICDSC tool, which is what I implemented for my project at Boston Medical. And I think that I like the ICDSC because it's, first of all, if the score is greater than 3, we can kind of say, hey, this patient might be getting delirious and implement intervention sooner. But I also really liked that it asked about sleep behaviors because we know that sleep has so much of an impact on the development of delirium. I liked that it specifically asks about like, how is the patient sleeping? Are they getting, you know, so much sleep on your shift? Because that is a huge factor. And that's one question that the CAM ICU tool does not take into account. I also like that where the CAM ICU tool was positive or negative, I like that this tool kind of had the numbers. I'm a math person, like I'm a numbers person. So for me, if I saw the number 3, that the patient was like heading towards delirium, in my mind, it would be like, okay, let me like implement some interventions sooner. Right. Versus if it's just positive or negative, I don't know that nurses are necessarily implementing interventions if the score is negative.
Right. One's more black and white, and then the ICDSC has a little more gray where you can kind of intervene early. What would you say we're doing for interventions? Like when you say that we're going to intervene early, what do you mean by that?
So one thing is really taking the environment into account. You know, I will go into patients' rooms and let's say the family was visiting and they wanted to watch the football game earlier. So they were visiting, they turn the TV on, they leave, you know, the Patriots game on, and then they leave. And then that TV stays on for hours. And if the patient's intubated or if they're sedated, that doesn't mean they can't hear. And that stuff all plays, like listening to that ambient noise all plays a part in the development of delirium because they're not going to get that REM sleep. Right. So turning the TV off, turning the lights off during daytime hours, making sure the lights are on, the shades are up at night, making sure the lights are off, shades down. You know, sometimes people on days, they're like, I just want to take a nap. That's fine. You can take a nap, but we really want to keep the lights on because we have to mimic our like REM sleep cycle. I'm sure some of us have been up later than we want to be. And then that really plays an impact in sleep. Just look at daylight savings time. It kind of throws people off when you're asleep, where you're, you know, you leave work, it's dark, you get to work, it's dark, that kind of thing. So I think that like that, those are huge interventions. We can also look at the medications the patients are on, but that's more so like the doctors, like working in conjunction with the doctors and saying, does the patient need like all of these sedatives? Because I think people forget sedation is not sleep. just because somebody is sedated because they need to be so that we can give them good care doesn't mean they're sleeping. So looking at like the medication list, but the huge one that nurses can do is really looking at the environment and seeing how we can make things like better from a noise and light perspective.
Yeah. When you're talking about the medications and the sedatives for these patients, do you think that there's a difference between the types of sedation that are being used that affect delirium and or the duration of time that these patients are on these medications?
Yeah. So the ABCDEF bundle that I talked about earlier, that some of those components ask the team to look at sedation and try to figure out what can we take them off of, or like what kind of doses can we have them on to really impact, to really help them like get out of the ICU. And so we'll take a med like propofol. Propofol is a pretty heavy anesthetic, but it's a fast on, fast off, meaning you can pause it and the patient's going to wake right up. So that medication is better for our patients than something like a Valium or a Versed, like which is a benzo, which sits in the body for longer. So if you have somebody on that medication, they're not going to wake up as quickly. So that's going to have worse outcomes because the patient's going to be sedated for longer versus a propofol. That's, you can turn that off and really assess their neurostatus pretty quickly. The big thing is that the Society of Critical Care Medicine says, let's just like wean these medications as we much as we can, like put them on the lowest dose possible so that they wake up, we can like interact with them, but they're hopefully like when they're on these medications, we just want the lowest dose.
Right. Yeah. We want them to be safe, but we want to do the least amount of harm for these patients. I think one of the things nurses do in the ICU is their SAT and SBT, which are their spontaneous awakening trial and spontaneous breathing trial while they're on a ventilator. And I kind of feel like almost it's a way to get them off the ventilator sooner, but it's also a way to kind of decrease the sedation sooner. And mm-hmm. can they tolerate a lower dose of medications than maybe what they were getting before? Right.
And that's all best practices that the Society of Critical Care Medicine puts forward.
Yeah. And so I kind of want to know a little bit more about the patients that develop delirium and the treatment. What do we do for them once we realize our early warning signs, our scores are a 3? What are we doing besides, you know, the sleep-wake cycle, the lights in the room, the decreasing, the stimulation? But now they have delirium. They're ready to go. Their initial indication of being in the hospital has resolved, but now we have delirium. Mm-hmm. What are we doing for these patients?
That's the unfortunate thing. There's no, you know, medication that we can give them that's a cure-all that's going to say, okay, you're not going to have delirium if you take this medication every day. It's just, you know, frequent reorientation to their environment and really trying to maintain that normal sleep-wake cycle. That's a big, big part of it. But there's no quick fix for the patients that develop delirium, which is why identifying it sooner is so important.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your project that you did for delirium for your doctorate of nursing practice, and kind of explain what you did, how you implemented it, and what were the results? What did you find?
All right. So we at Boston Medical Center use the CAM ICU tool right now to assess delirium. So every shift, the nurses are going in and asking some of these questions that I referred to. So do they have a change in mental status? Do they have inattention? Are they able to like logically, sequentially follow some of your questions that you're asking, like squeeze my hand when I say the letter A? So that tool's been in use and it's in the electronic health record. We do that every single shift. I was looking to see if we implemented a different tool, the ICDSC, if that would impact length of stay, because we know that delirium leads to a longer length of stay. And then when they have longer length of stay, they have worse outcomes, you know, cost wise, just medical wise, they just have worse outcomes overall. So I wanted to see if we implemented a different tool, if those patients would have a decreased length of stay, because then maybe if they did, we could consider switching to a different tool that we use in practice. So I had to first get IRB approval, which is the Institutional Review Board. Every hospital pretty much has an Institutional Review Board, and it's basically a way for, you know, you can't do a study unless it's ethically sound. You can't investigate patients unless you're showing the hospital, like, is this safe? Is this going to have an impact on patients? Right. So I had to get Institutional Review Board approval, and the IRB approval is basically it's exempt, meaning it's not going to harm patients, or you have to kind of go through like this whole gamut of like additional questions. Is this going to affect patients? So even though this project could affect patients in the long term, it was not going to cause harm to the patients to do this tool. So after, I think, 6 weeks, I got IRB approval that this study was exempt. So it can take a long time. And if it's your first time going through the IRB, don't expect it to be quick, because all these little like minute details that you don't even think about, they want to know. So you have to kind of describe how you're going to do the project and what you're going to do and what kind of impacts it's going to have to the patients. So I finally got IRB approval. And then I did education for the nurses. When I was doing this project, I covered two medical ICUs. So one's a 17-bed unit and one's a 10-bed unit. And I got some advice, you know, make it small. So I decided to just implement this in the 10-bed ICU. And so I did education with the nurses for over a two-week period. I sent out emails, like, and I had a PowerPoint. And then as the nurse educator, you know, I'm there every day. I'm there during the week. So it was a little bit of a bias that I am the educator for the unit that I did this project in, because I would have nurses say to me, oh, I forgot to do my tool today when I showed up in the unit. So it was that I had to talk about that in my findings, that, you know, if I did this in a different unit, maybe there wouldn't be like that bias to do the survey. So I did all this education, and then for a four-week period, I basically just asked the nurses, hey, can you do your tool? Hey, can you do your ICDSC survey? We could not build this into the electronic health record, so I made a tool on something called REDCap. So it's a platform that you can use to make surveys, and I made QR codes, and I put them on the computers in every at the nurse's station, and ask the nurses basically to scan this once a shift and evaluate their patient for delirium using this tool. And then I also sent secure chat messages to the unit, which is something within the health record that it doesn't become part of the patient's medical record, but I was able to like send them messages with the link to the survey. So if they didn't want to scan the QR code, they could click the link to go to this survey. And I did that for 4 weeks, and then I closed the survey and was able to do my data analysis piece. So what I found was no statistical difference between using the CAM ICU tool and using the ICDSC. The mean, like the average length of stay, did decrease, but there were a lot of outliers. Like there were some patients that pre-tool implementation, there was one patient that was there for like 36 days. So there were outliers which like affected the length of stay average. So what I really looked at was the median length of stay to kind of take these outliers away. And both groups of patients, the first group was the patient, it was in May 2025. I looked at like the 1 month prior to implementation. The May 2025 median length of stay was 2 days. And then I implemented the project in June, and the median length of stay in June 2025 during the project was also 2 days. So no statistically significant difference, which I guess is good, because, you know, the Society of Critical Care Medicine does say these tools are both equally as reliable. So I did see that they're both reliable to detect delirium. But a lot of factors go into that. You know, what kind of patients did we have? Did we have more ventilated patients versus non-ventilated patients? Did the time of year make a difference? Did we have more patients with respiratory issues versus not? And then just the fact that delirium was talked about so much for this kind of like 2 month period, nurses were more aware of it. So because they were more aware of it, were they better at assessing delirium in June versus in May before I did education? And did that have an impact on length of stay because they were more aware of what classifies as like delirium?
Yeah. Do you think if you implemented this study over a longer period of time, do you think you would have different results?
I don't know. You know what I want to do is I collected a lot of data for this project so that I can go back into the charts if I need to. One thing I did not look at was demographics. Mm-hmm. So Boston Medical Center is it's a hospital that takes care of a lot of people with social determinants of health. So social determinants of health are like where you live, what kind of education you have. And these patients actually tend to develop delirium more. That's what the literature supports. So patients that have a lot of social determinants of health develop more delirium. And because we take care of this population of patients, I wonder if I were to do this study again, if I looked specifically at patient demographics like age or race or gender, if that would have an impact. So it's something I could consider in the future. But for the purposes of this project, I had somebody tell me, you just want to be done with school. So don't get too much into the nitty gritty at this point. It's always something I can look at in the future.
Yeah. Implementing it on a bigger scale.
Yeah.
How did you feel the nurses liked the delirium scale as opposed to using the CAM scale that they were used to?
I think anecdotally, they seemed to like it. I think it's kind of hard because it wasn't in the chart, like it wasn't in the electronic health record, which you don't want to ask nurses to do something that's going to impact like the flow of their day. This survey takes about 2 minutes to complete, so it wasn't a huge ask. But I think if it was in the chart, it would just be easier for the nurses versus having something that they had to do extra. I think the nurses liked that there was a question about sleep.
Yes.
I think that's what I heard the most is that they liked it, that it asked about sleep. So if I were to, you know, bring this forward to the critical care group at the hospital, I would probably mention that I didn't find a difference, but nurses seemed to like it better because they were able to evaluate sleep a little differently.
Yeah. So I happen to be one of those nurses that utilize your tool. And I do have to admit, I did like it better. I thought the questions were clearer. And I felt having a number, I'm more of a numbers person too, having that number really kind of triggered me to look into what we're doing for the patient and how we can make some changes to reduce delirium.
Yeah. Yeah.
Overall. All right, Allison. So where does this project go for you? What were the next steps?
So I am 8 weeks out from being done with my doctoral program.
Yay,
I'm taking some time off because it's the holidays and, you know, holidays get very busy.
Yes,
so I'm taking some time off. But when I start back probably around mid-December, I have 8 weeks to prepare my final manuscript to present it to my doctoral committee and basically defend it. And I just have to show what I did for this project and make recommendations for the future. And then I will be done. I asked my boss, you know, this doesn't really impact me at work, but I asked my boss, what's my goal for the next 2 years, you know, until the next time I kind of meet with her for my review. And she wants to see me get published or at least submit an abstract. So you can submit abstracts to different conferences that talk about delirium. When you present at a conference, a lot of times it's this is like the hot topic of the month. So I don't know that delirium is like a hot enough topic right now, but I do think contributing this to like the body of knowledge on delirium is important. Even though I didn't find any significant changes, there are not many studies out there that compare the two tools. So I think that it could be something I could present at a conference, and I would like to do that. I think once I'm done with school, I need a vacation, but I do see myself, I'm definitely a lifelong learner. So I do see myself like trying to make things better and like move forward with this. If the nurses will let me, you know, I have really great, fantastic nurses. You're one of them, but I really do have great nurses that I think just working in the ICU, they appreciate like evidence-based practice. So if I can do anything to help contribute to evidence-based practice, I would like to do that. And I really think I would have the support of the staff, because they all, anytime something new gets implemented, they want to know why.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So I guess maybe some take homes for some nurses out there who are taking care of patients who may, you know, be in a situation where they're caring for someone who may develop delirium or who has delirium. Are there any bits of advice you can provide for them on how to prevent it? Anything we can leave our audience with?
I think environmental factors play a huge role. So really be aware. And it sounds so silly, like turn the light off when you leave the room or keep the light on. But that really does make a difference. And I think just the ICU delirium tools that we have, ask questions that people might think are silly. When you, you know, have your patient squeeze my hand when I say the letter A, that seems so silly to ask a patient to do that. But these are evidence-based tools that we use that have been validated. They've been validated in different languages, in different countries. So it's really important to ask those silly questions, because it really does give you an idea of who's going to develop delirium or who is delirious. Because remember, the ones that are hypoactive are the ones that are missed. So if you ask your patient who is not really interacting with you these silly questions, you can really find out about how, if they are delirious. And so it's really just using these tools that we have at our disposal to really try to evaluate delirium so we can find it sooner.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that advice. And for all our listeners out there, delirium is important and we need to pay attention to it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I really appreciate you letting me talk about delirium, which somehow became a passion of mine in the past few years. I never thought I'd get to a point where I'd be passionate about delirium, but it really is important.
It is. And it affects a lot of patients. So we appreciate all the work that you have done for this and for your project and for your school, and congratulations on being almost done.
We're super thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you everyone for listening today, and for our special guest, Allison Kilbline. If you have any topics you'd like us to discuss or any suggestions, you can email us at makemesickpod@gmail.com. And you can find and listen to us on X at makemesickpod. And you can listen to us on Apple and Spotify Music at You Make Me Sick with an exclamation point. And just a special reminder for all of our listeners to please wash your hands. Flu season is upon us.